Hello, everyone. We are about to get started with the Tamarisk Coalition funding webinar series in just a moment. It looks like people are just now joining us, so wait maybe one more minute before beginning. Please confirm that you can hear me so that we can make sure that everything's working as it should be. Okay, confirmation that you can hear me. Great. Well, welcome to the fifth installation of the Tamarisk Coalition Funding Webinar Series. This is one of the first webinars that will be focusing on sustainable funding mechanisms for restoration work as opposed to specific grants. So I'm excited to invite our two presenters and have them speak today. We're going to be focusing the conversation today on payment for watershed services models that have taken place throughout the United States. A word about the Tamarisk Coalition. If you're not familiar with our organization, we are a nonprofit organization based in Colorado, but we work throughout the southwestern U.S. and the Colorado River Basin, helping various partnerships do restoration work on the ground. And we provide a wide array of resources to those partnerships to include help with restoration planning, development of plant materials and revegetation plans, funding resources, informational conferences, and much more. If you would like to learn more about the Tamarisk Coalition, you can visit our website at www.tamariskcoalition.org. A few points about web conferencing. Everyone will be muted during the presentations, so please note that that you will not be heard and that all questions will be taken after the presentations have concluded. Therefore, please write down any questions that might occur to you during the course of the presentation. Also, if you are having any technical difficulties or do need to share information, please feel free to do so in the chat box, and I will do my best to monitor any questions that come up in there. Most of you have already done so, and your names do show when you log in, but it would be great if you could type in your name and organization into the chat box if you haven't done so already, as sort of a means for signing in as a sign-in sheet. Also, you might want to make sure and mute your computers so that you're not getting feedback both through the phone and on the computer. We are doing the audio component of the presentation through the phone so that people can ask questions at the end. When you do ask questions, please mention your name and affiliation. And when I prompt you, the means for asking questions will be press star one. Also, we really, really appreciate it if you take the time to fill out our evaluation survey after the webinar. I will put the link up in the chat box. It's through SurveyMonkey. So if you're not able to access that presentation after the conference, or the webinar, then you can send me an email and I'll send that information. We have some future webinar series that are being developed, and those will be focused on funding for restoration in Utah, funding for restoration in private lands, funding for restoration in Arizona, and some common pitfalls of grant writing and fundraising. We do not have specific dates lined up for these events yet, but you will be receiving announcements about those webinars in the future just to kind of get you in the know about what we're thinking about. Also, we are always taking suggestions for ideas for future webinars, so feel free to send those or input those into the evaluations as well. So I am going to invite Story Clark, who is a consultant, lecturer, and author specializing in conservation finance, to present today. She's going to talk to us about various payment for watershed services programs. Story Clark works with clients that include land conservation organizations, foundations, municipalities, and individuals. She is the lead organizer and lecturer for the conservation finance boot camps that take place at Yale and Stanford universities and offers an intensive training to practitioners and graduate students in conservation finance techniques. She's also the author of the soon-to-be published A Field Guide to Conservation Finance and is launching her mobile device app, Travel Story GPS, which she will be speaking about. I'm going to pull up her presentation right now, and Story, if you would unmute yourself.
I'm here.
Okay, great. Just one moment. Okay, just a second here. Oh, great. Take it away, Story. Thanks so much.
Great. Well, thank you so much. It's really a pleasure and an honor to be on this webinar, and I look forward to getting lots of questions and learning from your experiences, too. So I've basically spent my entire career looking for new sources of money for conservation, mostly in the land conservation area, transactions, and organizational operations. I'm learning more about restoration funding, but I'm basically going to be presenting on experiences that we're having and we've had in finding funding in the land conservation, i.e. acquisition and operations and stewardship end. And I hope that a lot of that will be applicable to what you all are doing. Some of the techniques I'm going to talk about are featured in my first the first volume of A Field Guide to Conservation Finance, which came out a few years ago, and others will be featured in the second volume, which will be out in the next year. But in everything I do, the bottom line for my research is money. So when I offer a case study in the course of this webinar, it's because the organizations that used this technique did it, and they received more money, more funding by doing it. So there are obviously other very beneficial aspects of moving into new funding strategies, but I am highlighting them because they made more money, had more money by doing it. All of the strategies that I'm discussing have costs. Whenever you try something new, there's going to be costs. There's going to be opportunity costs, learning costs, and sometimes it's going to be very hard to do something new. So I'm not going to talk about those because I don't have a lot of time, but if you want to talk about the downsides, if you get serious about going into one of these techniques, let me know, and I'm happy to talk about it, or I explore it in great detail in my first volume, and I will in my second volume. I'm going to move very quickly through my slides because I have a lot of them. I have a lot because I want to leave you with a lot of case studies, so in case you want to pursue some one of these techniques, you'll have a good place to start. If you want more detail or if you want me to slow down or if you want to ask questions and go back to other slides, we can certainly do that. So that's just my introduction. Okay, one second here. I just have to... Okay, so what I really want to do in this session is start pretty far away from watershed funding and move down to it. I really want to challenge you to think in a new way about finding funding. And the reason is that we have tried the old ways and we've found money, but we're also seeing real limits. And the second reason is because there really is new money in these new techniques and in this new way of thinking. So it's worth taking a look. So really our goal in the past, at least in my sector of conservation, most of our funding came from the government and a fair amount came from individual and foundation donors. In your case, you probably got fee for services also. I'm not sure whether that's true, but Then in the last few years, really since 2008, all of our funding has really shrunk, even as we were starting new strategies. So really what we're looking for the future is probably not the same amount of government funding that we saw, you know, back before 2008, and probably more donor giving as time goes on and the economy goes back. But I think all of us are really relying on new strategies as a way to kind of fund us out into the future. But unlike the past, there are no silver bullets, and there used to be. We all used to get, you know, big sources of money, and that's just not the case. I'm sorry this is cut off a little bit here, but maybe it isn't on your slides. But this is really the array of funding sources for conservation that I track. And there are always more, they're always developing, but do not give up hope, even though there are no silver bullets. There are still a lot of places to go for money, and it's growing every day. But the new model is really a multiple financial source model. We have this sort of stack of pancakes, and we find a little bit of money here and a little bit of money there, and these are really the sources that we currently are using. And what we need to do is really expand those. And that's what I'm going to talk about in on the rest of this webinar, places we can go to expand, find new pancakes. So again, just to sort of say this in a different way, we've had our traditional sources, but we're really going to be looking in new places for new sources. And one of the big places we're going to be looking is in what I'm calling natural capital. And that's really going to be the focus of what Marcus is talking about and the focus of what sort of the second half of my presentation will be on. So how do we tap into these new sources of conservation capital? Well, first we have to identify them. And frankly, identifying them is a big part of the problem because we're not used to thinking this way. We're not used to thinking about community assets and how we can monetize them. How do we turn non-cash sources of funds in our communities into cash sources of funds? So I'm going to spend a bit of time helping you learn to think that way. Then the second thing is really to build strong relationships with people in working with those assets, because you may be the best salesman in the world, but if you're not a member of the tribe that manages that asset, whether it be a utility company or a business or whatever, there's just not the level of trust as there is with somebody who's in that tribe, and we are still very tribal. So the best thing to do is to find a contact, find a friend, a champion in that particular arena, and have them champion it for you. And that's really how you're going to really move most seamlessly into a new sector and find new sources of money. Then I strongly recommend you learn from case studies. Lots of these techniques have been tried. Some of them have failed. You learn more from failure than you learn from success. So find case studies and make a few calls, learn about how it's been done in the past. Then you have to develop tools to monetize the assets, and we'll talk about that. Test them, make adjustments, and go for it. So where are we going to find all this conservation capital? Well, I'm dividing it into three sectors, mainly just to help in thinking about it. Community capital, and those are the partners in your community that have funding, mostly nonprofits, but others, and we'll discuss. Financial capital, where is the actual cash in your community, and how can you access it legally? And finally, natural capital, which is really when we get into this whole question of watershed payments, and what in nature can be monetized, and of course, watersheds is one important aspect of nature that can be monetized. So community capital, what do I mean? I mean other nonprofits, I mean voters. If you have a sympathetic voting community that might be willing to pass a bond issue to provide open space and restoration funding for your community, go for it. Do you have a private sector that is very active in your community? Political leaders, government agencies. So the real way to talk in your community about conservation is a way that we really haven't been talking in the past. we've really been talking about what we do, whether that's protecting animals or scenery or restoring a stream. We haven't thought as much as we need to about how conservation is really the foundation of most community capital. And I did this little exercise just taking the pieces of land conservation on one side, clean water, filtration, healthy soils, and then matching it up with key ingredients in your community, just so that we can see how interconnected all of this is. We need to start talking about conservation and restoration in terms of what it does for community, and here are just a few suggestions. Underlying all of this is making the human community connection. So you all know better than anybody that clean water helps produce clean drinking water, which helps human well-being. At every opportunity, we need to walk through that step so in the end we get to human well-being, because that's what really matters to humans. So one way to approach community capital is to look around your community and see where the money is in nonprofits. So this is in the United States. This is how money is given to nonprofits. So you can see the environment, which includes animal protection, gets only 2% of the charitable dollars that are actually available and given in the United States. So, you know, my philosophy is always go where the money is. So looking at the places that I should be going in my community for money, I should be going to education, I should be going to religion, I should be going to the arts. You know, just look in your community and what nonprofits really are receiving the greatest amount of money, and I can guarantee you there's a connection you can make with that nonprofit that has to do with conservation, going back to that previous grid that I showed you. So just a few examples. Conservation is stepping into the health arena, really applicable to the kind of work that you all do. These are just two small land conservation groups. The upper one made a wonderful partnership with a hospital network in their community in Pennsylvania. The hospital ended up by printing their brochures and sending them out to all of the hospital mailing list because they wanted their people and their patients out using the trails and parks and open spaces that the conservation organization was working in. Hugely beneficial, increased the membership of the for the land conservation organization, got a lot more people involved in their program. At the Androscoggin Land Trust up in Maine tapped into a tobacco settlement in Maine and was able to team up with something called Healthy Androscoggin, which has the goal of reducing tobacco use. So lots of opportunities there, a lot of money there. They put it into river restoration, getting people out on the rivers. This river, the Androscoggin River, was one of those rivers that was on fire when the Clean Water Act was first approved, and now it's clean. So, you know, lots to be proud of there, and new money flowing from this settlement to health and conservation. Another example is partnerships for education. You know, that's everybody wants to do that. This is a great little land trust in the Midwest. Only 11 people on the staff. They get 7,000 children out onto their properties every year. They have partnerships with schools. They have a foundation that pays all the bus fees. You know, really a wonderful way to connect with education. The voters. The voters are community capital. Local and state ballot initiatives have produced more money in the last 20 years than conservation has really gotten through the traditional sources from the Department of Interior. Of course, the Farm Bill produces more money, but this source has produced $19.5 billion for land conservation by local people, statewide people, raising their hands and voting to be taxed so that money would roll to conservation in their communities. This is a nice one. This is a restoration project along the Hudson River. Scenic Hudson teamed up with a developer and brought in a lot of state money and also private money to restore a brownfield and produce a 15-acre park that restored wetlands and the stream banks and did a lot of other things that have generated a lot of business for that community. It's in a town called Beacon, New York, which is has not been doing well. And so in addition to doing conservation, the private sector partnership produced economic development. So another form of capital is financial capital. And where do we find that in our community? So obviously the banks have it, but that's harder to access. Tourism. If you have a tourist-based economy and you should look for the strongest economic sectors in your community, how do we tap that tourist dollars? Are you a community based on commerce? How do we tap those dollars that come into your community through commerce? How do we tap the commuters that drive through your community? And then, of course, the wealthy residents are probably the easiest place. So I'm just going to give you two fun, innovative case studies for monetizing tourism in new ways. That's a lot of money in America, and it's a lot of money, I'm sure, in a lot of your communities. But it's really hard for us to get our hands on that money. So here are two ways, one that's proven and the other that I'm working on and hopefully will be proven soon. So the first are voluntary surcharges. So this is an opt-out model where businesses in your community agree to add a percentage or a base amount of $1 or $2 onto every bill. And then the customer is asked if they want to take the money off of the bill. Rather than asking for a donation, which gets a less than 1% return, you ask to opt out. You have to opt out, and you get less than 1% opting out because it's trouble to opt out. It's easier to leave the money in. So this is really pioneered in Crested Butte, Colorado, in a program called 1% for Open Space. Since it started in 1997, they've generated $1.65 million for conservation efforts, and they generate about $100,000 to $130,000 a year in revenue. There are 70 businesses participating, and I like this little example from a restaurant receipt. This is actually from another program in Truckee, California, where they have it on restaurants. And as you can see, this person is purchasing, got two mushu pork, and they got some edamame. And then the land trust, they also bought $1 for the land trust. And then there's a circled area below which says you can omit the $1 if you don't want to do it. So this has really been rolled out in lots of communities around the U.S. and is a very successful way in a tourist-based community to generate revenue. And in my first book, I have a whole chapter on that, so you can learn a lot from that if you're interested. The second one I want to speak to is something that I have been developing for the last 4 years. As I've seen America and the world get on smartphones and mobile devices and apps, my feeling was we had to meet people where they were, which is on their phones, in their cars, on trails, on rivers. We couldn't expect them to come to us. So I developed a mobile phone, mobile device app called Travel Stories GPS. It's GPS-triggered audio tours. So as you drive along or float along a river or bike or hike, the stories about the landscape that you are seeing come on as audio. And it reaches people where most people are these days, which even on trails, which amazes me, which is on their smartphones. And it connects them to the landscape. And it's also a tool for accessing the tourist dollar because it has a solicitation function that I'll tell you about in a minute. So it's a shared platform that all conservation organizations can use to tell their story. So without developing your own phone app, which is expensive and complicated, you can actually put your route on this app, Travel Stories GPS. And eventually I'm hoping that we'll have routes all over the United States. So there'll be a lot of cross-promotion, cross-marketing from various routes. Your route will cross-promote with the routes we're doing up here in Jackson, Wyoming, and vice versa. As you can hear, I've just put up some of the screenshots. On the right, you'll see the geotags. It's hands-free, so as you're driving, as you pass those tags, new stories come on. There's text relating to the tour, and then there are images and videos that enrich the experience. And then here's the solicitation function, because I'm interested in tapping the tourist dollar, so it's an important feature. There's a real-time audio solicitation. It's a $5 gift and a link to the nonprofit that sponsors it. No credit cards or PayPal is involved. It's just three taps on the phone. So it has this fundraising and outreach function, and it solicits visitors while they're experiencing the landscape, not on December 31st when they're staring at your solicitation as they're trying to figure out who they're going to support that year. So that's a little bit about how I'm trying to think in a new way about tapping into the tourist dollar. So finally, natural capital. So natural capital is really this new and very interesting source of funding for land conservation. And what is it? Well, is it wildlife? Is it forests, wetlands, rivers? In your areas, it's absolutely watersheds, but we're going to walk through some of these others. So what is natural capital? Well, natural capital is really ecosystem services with financial value. In other words, they're services that nature provides that we can monetize and create actual cash funding or protection from them. Those are just a few of them. Just to give you an example of the value of natural capital, pollination, one-third of all the food we eat is naturally pollinated. You've probably heard these statistics before. The honeybee, it's the estimated value as an important pollinator in U.S. agriculture, produces about $14.6 billion the last time it was really analyzed in 2000. So, you know, very, 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 very valuable. I read one study that said that each bee has a value of about $75 in terms of the pollination. So, you know, that's the connection between ecosystem services and money. Well, that's one connection. Just to give you, there's some very good studies out. One is called the TEEB study, T-E-E-B, really groundbreaking study of monetizing ecosystem services. And from that study, this is just an example of all the different services that come out of a tropical forest. In the United States, we're seeing sort of different ways of monetizing those ecosystem services. We have community forests where communities are buying their forests and when they're threatened and producing jobs, producing social capital and community capital, economic stabilization, whole series of benefits by protecting a forest. That's a form of monetization. Just in Wyoming, obviously, and all around the West, hunting is a form of monetization for wildlife, but also just accounting for the non-consumptive value of wildlife. This was an interesting study that came out last year, actually that analyzed the number of jobs that were created by our Wildlife Trust Fund, which provides funding to preserve and conserve habitat for wildlife and restore habitat. So now we get to what you've all been waiting for, which is monetizing wetlands. And how do we do that? So, watersheds. So how do we do that? What are the techniques that conservationists use? Well, they use GIS mapping so they can understand the watershed and where the watershed is particularly important to be protected. They need transactional expertise because a lot of what they're doing is actually conserving little bits of the watershed and having it all add up. They need to work with landowners because often these watersheds are privately owned, but not always. And they need out-of-the-box thinking, which is where we're going with this. So just a few examples of some out-of-the-box thinking. You know, working with water utilities, they're the ones who really can benefit financially from using a natural filtration system rather than having to build expensive filtration plants. But beverage companies also benefit tremendously from a protected watershed because for the same reason, they use a lot of water for their products. And I have some great case studies that if you're interested, I can tell you about that involve beer companies and other companies in helping to protect watersheds. And then foundations are very interested because there's a real cause and effect that's pretty close between protecting a watershed and benefiting humans. So, and then agencies, and the Forest Service owns a lot of watersheds, other agencies do, and working with them, and I have a case study on that. There are other ways that you can't see, you probably can't see the title. There's damage funding that comes from pollution of water watersheds that can be tapped into. That's, you know, on a very case-by-case basis. But, you know, check your papers. Make sure there isn't a lawsuit going on with a company about pollution, because that money can come to conservation, but you have to be there at the right time to kind of grab it when the settlement is made. But lots of conservation groups have generated, have been able to capture tremendous amounts of money from pollution damage settlements. This is FERC relicensing. I'm not sure whether that's really applicable in your area, but if there are dams in your area that get relicensed, that's another place to kind of get your fingers into, because the resolution of those licensing agreements, which often take years, can really produce a lot of mitigation funding as part of the second or third generation of licensing. So now we're really at the crux here. Finally, I know you've been patient. Payments for watershed services. I'm going to run through a few case studies just to kind of set the stage for what Marcus is going to be talking about. But really the bottom line here is the cost per pound of reducing nitrogen. And there are other pollutants, too, that need to be taken out of water in order for it to be drinkable. But this is a pretty compelling argument for a natural means of filtering water rather than building a treatment plant. Or building a treatment plant is one thing, but upgrading a treatment plant is just hugely, hugely more expensive. And I just want to point out, just so you know, there is a very large amount of federal money that is kind of sitting there underutilized by conservation groups for watershed protection. And it's the State Clean Water Revolving Loan Funds. And if you don't know about them, you should know about them. They're guarded by engineers that like to see the money go to sewer plants, but really they should be used for watershed protection. And there's a move in the conservation community to open up the gates here. California, New York, even some western states have had good results. We're talking about billions of dollars, $90 billion in this fund that is available with some work, but is still available for watershed protection. So there's some small case studies of water utility payments. These are utility companies that do fund conservation efforts in their areas because they understand the connection. And there are many, many of these, and I'm just pointing out a few of them. But there are also some very big ones that you probably have heard of, and New York City is the most famous. New York City basically was faced with the need in 1997 to build a new filtration plant because of EPA was telling them that the quality of their water wasn't good enough. So instead of building that filtration plant, they went up to the watersheds above New York City, and they started doing conservation. And it took them many years, and it's a fabulous, fascinating story. But in the end, they saved over $2 billion, and that's in capital costs, plus their hundreds of millions of dollars they saved in annual financing costs by taking this approach. So it's really a fascinating story. It's a scale that doesn't apply really to any of us, but it gives us all hope that if a place like New York City can monetize its watersheds through conservation, we all should have a shot at doing that. A few other interesting examples, Salt Lake City. People don't really think of Salt Lake City as being a pioneer in watershed protection, but it's really been part of the Mormon tradition. Ever since the Mormons first came to Salt Lake, they knew that the mountains over Salt Lake City provided the clean water. And ever since then, the utilities have been adding on to every person's bill a small monthly surcharge that goes to acquire and conserve lands around Salt Lake City. The Denver model is different. It involves the law preventing the loss of forests because forests are protecting and filtering the water. Very concerned about beetle kill, pine bark beetle kill, and fire, which can devastate a watershed. So they're also monetizing their watershed by charging money to their users and putting that money back into the forest for restoration and fire prevention. And then this one I love. This is a pretty new case study, and it's worth looking at it because it's tough and challenging. It's an area in North Carolina. It's the Triangle, the three cities there, Raleigh being the leader. Raleigh, the mayor of Raleigh, and this gets back to really this point about leadership, the mayor of Raleigh was approached by the riverkeeper for the Neuse River, who said, you guys are faced with the same problems that New York City was faced with in terms of EPA saying your water isn't clean. You need to do something about that. Why don't you do some watershed protection? So the mayor was quite open-minded, and he said, hey, how do you do that? I have no idea how to do that. And the conversation continued, and the land trusts in the area were involved in it. But really one of the things that was key to making this project successful was that his utility director for Raleigh had come from Salt Lake City. And so he was very, very comfortable with this idea of using surcharges to help buy conservation of watersheds. But what's really interesting is that the actual watershed is nowhere near Raleigh. And so this program, which just started a few years ago, they really had to think about where the water was coming and the ecosystem services that were far away that had to be protected. And they really launched this whole program with the help of 7 land conservation organizations to really see if they could start protecting a very polluted watershed. And, you know, it's going well. It's a tough one, but it's going well. And I can point you in the direction of some people to talk to there if you're interested. It's very urbanized area, lots of tiny little parcels of land. The Land Trust did a lot of GIS work to identify the most critical parcels of land in terms of soil and geology to protect to help improve the water quality. And there's a lot of risk involved, but it's a good story. So, so just stepping way back, there are watershed payment programs all around the world. There's a new study that just came out, and you can find it on Ecosystem Service Marketplace, which is a website for ecosystem service sector and monetization, and there are currently about 205 active programs in the world and about 73 in development. The transaction value in 2011 from these programs is over $8 billion. So we're talking about a lot of monetization coming from watersheds already. And I'm sure you guys are thinking, gee, we have a long way to go, but take heart in the fact that there's a lot of programs underway around the world. So just finally, you know, this new way of thinking, it really requires you to just think holistically about your community and where the assets are, whether they're cash assets or natural capital assets, or whether they're community assets, such as other nonprofits. And, you know, some of it's luck. Circumstances, your capacity to jump into a new area, the opportunity, all affect your ability to monetize an asset. That's why early on in this webinar, I showed you that gigantic list of sources of funding, because not everything is going to work for you. And you kind of have to look around and pick ones that where you might have some of the skills, some of the relationships that it takes to monetize these assets. And then I just can't overstate the value of relationships with key people. It's the only way these programs get done. I can go through all of the case studies I mentioned, and they've all come to the brink at one time or another, and they've been pulled off the edge of the cliff by a relationship that has made it possible for these things to be successful. So don't forget not only the human connection to the land, but also your human connection in terms of reaching out to the right people to make these programs work. And then finally, you know, not all of these monetizing projects bring money right to your NGO, although some really do. But they bring new money to your communities, and that's your constituencies. So money to your community is de facto money in your pocket. So if you want to learn more about this whole field, this is my first book, which came out a few years ago, and I'm hoping if I can get my app off the ground, to which it actually is, it's in the pilot stages right now. We have a couple of great routes, and we're starting to work actually with the, one of your members on a route down in the southwest, and I have other clients all over the United States. So, but as soon as I can get that sort of off and running, I'll be able to finish Volume 2, which I hope to do this year, which will really feature a lot of what I've talked about so far. So thank you very much. I hope that wasn't too quick, and I hope you have some good questions. Thanks very much.
Thank you, Story. Wow, that was a lot of information that she covered. And so luckily we'll have a recording of this presentation and webinar, as well as a copy of the presentation available on our website for all of you to reference after this event has concluded, if you want to kind of go back and take a look at some of her slides. So next we have Marcus Selig, who will be presenting. He is the new director of the National Forest Foundation's Colorado program, and he's been in this position since January of this year. Prior to joining the National Forest Foundation, Marcus managed Arizona forest programs for the Grand Canyon Trust, where he worked on the two projects he will just discuss today. At the Grand Canyon Trust, he helped lead the stakeholder group of the Four Forest Restoration Initiative, a 2.4 million acre forest restoration project on northern Arizona's national forest. And he also helps develop various funding mechanisms to support forest restoration activities around the state. Marcus, if you would unmute yourself as I pull up your presentation, that would be great. Are you there?
Yep.
Okay. Thanks so much for joining us and presenting today. Take it away.
Yeah, thank you, and good afternoon, everyone, and thank you, Sori, for that presentation. That was great, and you kind of explained some of the unknown thought processes that I and others were stepping through as we were trying to figure out the examples that I'm going to share with you guys today. So I'm going to share two examples, and these hopefully are going to help provide some thoughts and general ideas and maybe some lessons learned, both good and bad, as you look at setting up some of these sustainable funding mechanisms. So as Kristen mentioned, I'm now working for the National Forest Foundation. I just started working in January. And for those who are unfamiliar, the National Forest Foundation is a congressionally chartered nonprofit that's really geared towards protecting and enhancing national forest system lands. And we do that by granting out money for community engagement, on-the-ground work, that we acquire through various funding mechanisms, some of which of the kind that Story already talked about. So it's very interesting to hear Story's conversation because it's very pertinent to what I'm doing now. So I'm going to just go ahead and step through these examples, but first I really wanted to make sure that everyone understands why these examples were set up, so the background of it. Like all western forests, the forests in northern Arizona are overly dense, which has the problem of leading to these large catastrophic fires. So in northern Arizona particularly, it's mainly ponderosa pine where we see this, but it exists all over Arizona with other types of ecosystems. In northern Arizona, they're fortunate enough to have this project that's in the works called the Four Forest Restoration Initiative. And this is really an effort to go in and fix those overly dense forests by doing some thinning activities and road decommissioning. And the effort stretches across about 2.5 million acres that start at the south rim of the Grand Canyon and extend all the way to the New Mexico border. And this effort is unique in the fact that it's really trying to engage industry at a large scale, the hope being that if we can work at a big enough scale, industry can come in and bring costs down to almost zero. And there's actually a contractor that's trying to get their feet off the ground that might be able to do that. So they're going and doing the thinning activities. But even with that effort, there's still going to be funding needs for that the contractor's not going to be able to help with. There's mechanical thinning needs, so getting out there and actually cutting the trees with machines. If the contractor can do that, that's great, but there's the possibility the contractor might not succeed, and additional funding will be necessary. There's also all kinds of complementary, I call them complementary restoration activities, but things like wildlife habitat improvements, spring channel restoration, aspen protection, all those types of activities. And there's also hand thinning for those areas that you can't reach with machines. And then there's the additional costs of any restoration activity, any good restoration activity, which is the monitoring costs. The federal government regularly struggles to meet their monitoring needs with their budget. So when you're thinking about funding needs, always throw in monitoring. And then long-term maintenance. It'd be a shame to do all this great work and then not have the money to keep it in place in case it can't all be maintained with fire. So those are the types of needs that we were looking at in northern Arizona and across Arizona. And we struggled a lot with how do we get people to pay for this. And so just as Story described, we started looking around for capital opportunities. And our strategy involved kind of two, and I'm going to talk about examples that hit on both those strategies. The first was a local strategy. So hitting folks and capital that are within the forest, that are in close proximity to the forest, that get direct benefits from restoration work. And you can see I put the X over Flagstaff. I'll be talking about the Flagstaff bond issue. And the second part of the strategy was taking a more statewide approach. This is because, one, we recognize that there's restoration needs all across the state, but two, because a lot of that capital is not in the forested areas of the state. So I say statewide, but I circled Phoenix, because that was really the capital that we saw, Phoenix and Tucson, where the population centers and capital are concentrated. So that was the strategy, and again, I'll start with the local, the Flagstaff bond question. So what this effort is really, for those who aren't familiar with a bond, it's a debt obligation that the city takes on and that's paid back through taxes to do some kind of work. And here the work was really to do forest thinning activities and forest restoration efforts to reduce the risk of fire and flooding. So the bond specifically, one of the reasons I want to talk about Four-Fry is because the bond relates closely to Four-Fry. A lot of the Four-Fry area is around the Flagstaff area. So this bond actually overlaps with some Four-Fry work and then also expands upon the scope of that Four-Fry work, meaning it's treating areas that Four-Fry would not otherwise treat. And the work is targeted towards two watersheds. There's the Rio de Flag watershed, which is kind of in proximity to downtown, and then the Lake Mary watershed, which is further east from town that surrounds the city reservoir. So I just have there some acreage numbers. The city bond is actually going to pay for almost 7,000 acres of hand thinning work in the Rio de Flag watershed, and then 4,000 acres of additional thinning work in the Lake Mary watershed. There's other numbers or work that's going to be done under the Four-Fry contract, so that's getting done anyway. So when we're looking around for a local example, where do we work with direct beneficiaries for capital to get this work done? Why do we look at Flagstaff? Well, there's a huge need for fire reduction activities around Flagstaff. We had the Schultz fire in 2010, which was very close to downtown. But there's the risk of additional fire there. So fire and proximity to town was a huge driver. And there's flooding potential. With the Schultz fire that we saw in 2010, we saw pretty catastrophic flooding afterwards. The area in the Rio de Flag watershed that's targeted through the bond if that area burned and then we had significant rainfall afterwards, we could have significant flooding in downtown Flagstaff. That would be in downtown, it would be at the college campus, it would hit a lot of neighborhoods. And so there's a big concern that these watersheds, the Rio de Flag watershed, needs to be treated to prevent that type of flooding. And then there's the water protection component, and this is the Lake Mary watershed. If the Lake Mary watershed were to burn, we'd get, as the story mentioned, pretty significant impacts to the water supply of the city reservoir, which is known as Lake Mary. That reservoir provides about 50% of the city's water, so it's important to take some preemptive actions to protect it. If that area burned, there'd be significant costs to get out the pollutants that would get in there from the sedimentation, and we'd also lose storage capacity from the actual sedimentation displacing the water in the reservoir. So Flagstaff has a lot of needs to get their watersheds treated. Beyond those immediate needs of fire and flooding and water, there's also the proximity relationship to the forest. So we looked at Flagstaff as a kind of prime target because residents of the Flagstaff area have a relationship with the forest because they live so close to it. They understand the needs, they understand the risks, and they're likely to take action to deal with those. The other reason to approach Flagstaff is the favorable politics. We have sympathetic voters in Flagstaff for this type of work as compared to the rest of Arizona. So Flagstaff is known as a fairly progressive city within Flagstaff or within Arizona. So we were definitely thought we had the best chances of success in Flagstaff. And the last reason to do it in Flagstaff is really the timing issue. As I mentioned, there was the Schultz fire in 2010, which is a pretty large, devastating fire, and had devastating flooding afterwards. And it's still fresh in the memories of a lot of people in Flagstaff. So while it's fresh in their memories and they recognize the risks associated with having unhealthy forests, we thought we'd put a bond measure in front of them that they could act on and prevent future events like that from happening. So then the question becomes, well, if we're going to do some work in Flagstaff and try to go after some of the capital that's there locally, why do a municipal bond? Well, there's some benefits that come with doing bonding as opposed to other funding mechanisms. First, it provides immediate funds. As I mentioned, it's a debt obligation that the city takes on that they pay back through taxes. And when they take that debt obligation on, they get a lump sum payment that they can work with. So we get, the city is now going to get $10 million pretty quickly that it can dole out and get the work done. So there's an immediate benefit of getting funds. The other part of it is low administration costs, relatively low. Bonds are collected or they're reimbursed through taxes. And so that's something that happens already, that the whole tax collection system. So we don't have to set up any new mechanism to collect these funds. They're put in through secondary property taxes. And the last one, and this is specific to Flagstaff and doing it this year, is timing. There was $10 million in bond and debt obligations retiring this year. And so by passing a new bond, we were actually replacing that debt obligation. So people's taxes aren't going to go up to pay for this bond. They're just not going to go down as the old bonds retire. So that was seen as a huge benefit. But using a municipal bond to pay for this type of activity also has its challenges. Municipal bonds, at least in Flagstaff and most communities, need to be voter approved. So we had to get the residents of Flagstaff to agree to this and vote for it. And the second one is it does increase secondary property taxes. So although that's great that mechanism is already set up, it is an increase in taxes, and this isn't the best timing to be increasing taxes to someone. So we saw those as challenges, but well, the challenge was worth it. So I next want to just kind of step you through the process on how we developed this $10 million bond. It actually didn't start that long ago. It was in March of last year. We decided we needed to do something. We needed to go after some of the Capitol and Flagstaff. So we set up a meeting, as a coalition of folks within the community, set up a meeting with city commissions. These are citizen-based commissions and staff-based commissions within the city of Flagstaff to talk to them about the need to treat these watersheds and the need to help pay for that treatment through some resource of the cities. So we had an initial meeting in March 2012. At that meeting, we actually didn't present the bond idea. I remember doing a presentation on a more traditional payment for watershed service model where funds would be collected through utility bills. But based on the timing of old bonds retiring and the benefit of getting a lump sum payment all at once to do this work, the city manager actually came up with the bond idea and steered us in that direction. After that meeting, we worked quickly to set up a community task force. This was a collection of environmental groups, scientists, community activists, to really design this bond measure. So we worked on that for a few months, preparing to present it to the city council. And the reason we had to present it to the city council is that they had to actually approve the bond measure to put on the November ballot for residents to vote on. So we worked hard with city staff, got that put together in a pretty tight fashion, and presented it to the city council in July, who unanimously approved its inclusion on the November ballot. And I think that it's important to note here the relationships, because as Story mentioned, so much of this depends on relationships, any type of development of a funding mechanism. It was important that we started with the city staff, who could help us understand the city commissioners and the city council, to present it to them in the right way and have the right information when we did it. And so by developing those relationships with the city staff and city manager, we almost ensured our success in front of the city council. So the next part in the process was then developing a public campaign. So we got it included on the ballot, but we had to basically sell it to the citizens of Flagstaff. I think it's important to distinguish here, too, there were two kind of campaign efforts. There was a city-based campaign effort that they're required to do any time a bond measure is presented, and theirs is strictly an informational campaign. They do a lot of presentations, going out to explain to people what the bond is and what type of work it's going to support. I helped lead the citizen campaign, and we didn't have to be as unbiased and informational. We could really be pro-bond, and we were very pro-bond. And we wanted to get the information out to folks, but we wanted to do it in a way that appealed to them. And because of the timing of the 2010 Schultz fire, we had, I don't want to call it a fear-based campaign, but we could show them the consequences of not doing the bond. And we based it on protecting property, protecting water, and protecting lives from fire and from flooding, and protecting the city reservoir. And those are pretty powerful messages to put out to a public, that if you don't do this, you're putting those items at risk. So we went around and did a lot of presentations based on that type of campaign to different citizen groups and organizations. We did postcard mailers, and we did very targeted postcard mailers. We had some neighborhoods that were predicted to flood in a post-fire rain event, and we were sure to make sure that people living in those neighborhoods received the flyer and received information that explained that their neighborhood was at risk of flooding. So we targeted them. We also targeted targeted the Democratic Party more so than the Republican Party as well, because we thought they might be more sympathetic from a tax increase. So we did get very targeted with our mailings. We also did yard signs. You can see an example of the yard sign in the lower left-hand corner that's protect our water, property, and lives, vote yes on 4 or 5. Pretty simple message. And for those yard signs that were placed in flood zones, we actually went around a couple weeks after they were put up by folks and slapped on a sticker over top of the sign, a red sticker that said potential flood zone, to let people know and kind of grab their attention. We did a lot of work with media outlets, newspapers, radio shows. We did some email blasts to various listservs that we had, and we produced a website So we had some pretty significant campaign efforts to get people informed about it and to let them know why they needed to vote for it. We were pretty successful. We had 74% voter approval in the election. And so October, November, I guess, for voter approval. That's, from what I understand, that's pretty unheard of for basically a referendum saying we want to increase taxes to pay for this work. So to get 74% of folks in favor of increasing secondary property taxes was pretty fantastic. So to look at why we had such success, we were fortunate enough to have Dr. Eric Nielsen and Dr. Fred Sala over at Northern Arizona University conduct some exit polling. And this is all pretty preliminary results. They're working on putting together their final analysis of that exit polling. But they wanted to look at why people said yes to this bond measure. And some interesting statistics, if you look at why people said yes. A majority said that they wanted to reduce the risk of post-fire flooding. That fits with the amount of press and the amount of devastation that happened from the Schultz fire flooding. That was the big deal from the Schultz fire, was the flooding. People didn't want that to happen again. They didn't want it to happen downtown this time and on the college campus. So I think that was a big motivator, and we also played that up with the campaign. The second most important, you know, that came 55 to 54%, pretty close to reducing the risk of flooding, was protecting city water resources. That, again, was something that we played up in the campaign, but I think that protection of water, especially in an arid state like Arizona, is pretty important to people. Something interesting to note, though, is that the risk of fire only motivated 33% of supporters. So fire was below flooding and water, and that's a little bit counter to what a lot of people think about why people would do something like this. You know, we've become so accustomed to being afraid of fire that that you would think that would be the main driver. But flooding and water tug more at the heartstrings, I think. You can also see that people had a lot of faith in the fact that this money would be used efficiently by the city and by the Forest Service. And that's something important to keep in mind as we move forward, is we need to make sure that that money is used efficiently and that people recognize that that money is being used efficiently through transparency. So efforts, as they continue on planning and implementation of this bond, are going to need to be very transparent to show people that they made the right decision. So when you look at issues that were important to opposition, so these are issues that were important to people that voted no. And if you look, the top three are all fiscal related, that the taxes are too high, that Flagstaff and the Forest Service will waste the money, or that they simply can't afford it. And that's, to me, that actually shows one of our shortfalls. This is not going to be an expensive tax for the people of Flagstaff. I think it's going to cost the average homeowner. So a homeowner that owns a $250,000 house in Flagstaff, it'll cost them $25 per year. And that's not something that we talked a whole lot about in the campaign. If we'd informed people of the low cost, I think we might have actually done even a little bit better. So that for me was a lesson learned. And then if you look below that, forest restoration is not a solution to water supply. That to me, that shows that we didn't do a good enough job educating, or it shows that people don't see forest restoration activities actually influencing water, and maybe they believe it's something more like climate change. But just some ideas to keep in mind. So now the city and the Forest Service are working on planning and implementation. They're working with some diverse stakeholders, but they need to try to be as transparent as possible to let people know that the money's being used, that it's being used efficiently, and they need to get work on the ground pretty soon. The city manager wants to have the first on-the-ground activities happening this spring to show voters right away that the money's being used. So they're in that effort, and I'm continuing to follow it, even though I'm in Colorado. I'm not engaged, but I am monitoring as much as I can, because I think it's going to be very interesting, and I think a lot more lessons learned are going to come out of that effort. So some immediate lessons learned, though, to take away from this are getting buy-in at the right levels. I think we did great working with the city manager before approaching the city council and having that message tailored and ready for success in that July approval. And building those relationships at the right levels is crucial anytime you're setting something like this up. The timing was very important. We needed to get it in this year while the Schultz devastation was still fresh in people's mind. And from a bond perspective, you can only vote on bonds every 2 years. So if we didn't do it this past year, we would have had to wait another 2 years. Third is campaigning on communities' past experiences. Anytime you're trying to sell something like this to anyone, you need to talk to them about what they know. And that is a large reason that we focused on the flooding and the fire, because folks knew it in the community. And the last is targeting your voters. I think we had a lot of success based on our mailers that went out, and that's because they were very targeted, and we went after those sympathetic voters. So those are kind of campaign-oriented lessons learned, but that's where we're at in the process. So those are immediate lessons learned. I think as it continues, we'll have other implementation and planning type lessons learned from this. So I have this slide in here, but just write down your questions down. We'll take them in a few minutes after I do the second part. So I talked, that was the flagship bond was the local approach. And now I want to talk about the statewide approach. And this is an ongoing effort. It's still very much in its infancy, but I think that there's still some lessons that can be taken away from this. We're going to be learning a lot of lessons as we, I think, face a lot of the challenges associated with the statewide effort. So, as I mentioned, we noticed that there's restoration needs all across the state, and that to maximize the capital in the state, we needed to take a statewide approach. So we formed what we call the Arizona Watershed Investment Fund. And this is a collection of collaboratives, forest restoration collaboratives from around the state, organizations, both federal and nonprofit, from around the state, and businesses and utilities. And if you notice, we called it the Arizona Watershed Investment Fund, and we put a lot of thought into this, and we thought the name was very important, and we wanted to get the word investment in there, because one thing that we hear from folks all the time is that they don't want to just give money, and mainly from businesses, they don't want to give money to feel good. They want to give money if it pays them back through some type of investment. So playing up the investment component, we think we'll have a lot of success with approaching businesses. So the mission is to do really two things. One is to educate and encourage statewide awareness of the need for and benefits of restoration work. And the second one is to then invest in restoration work by raising funds to invest. So this is kind of a schematic of this overall vision. I'm going to start from the bottom and work up, and this is the fundraising schematic. So at the bottom, you see 2.4 million residential electricity and water consumers, and this is across the state. There's the population's larger, but this is on a usage basis. So like a household, for instance. 2.4 million is not the entire state. It's 90% of the state. But 90% of the state is served by three major utilities within Arizona. Some of those, SRP is one of those. SRP is both a water and electricity utility. The other two that we're thinking of working with are strictly electricity utilities. And so when you look up, we have 2.4 million, then we have some type of collection mechanism that goes to one of those three utilities. This is really just using these utilities has a lot of benefits, but one of them is convenience, that they're really a uniquely situated collection mechanism because we have three utilities that serve 90% of the population. So if they were going to do something like include an opt-in or opt-out donation in their bill, it would be very efficient to use them to deliver money to a statewide fund. The thought is that we would do that, establish a statewide fund, which then could distribute money through a competitive grant process to various restoration efforts around the state. So that was kind of the overall plan. It has, like I said, the benefit of efficiency of being able to collect a little bit of money from a lot of people. And so this shows you how much a little bit of money can do when you blow it up across the state. So if we collected 10 cents from each of those customers and we had 100% participation, we could get $2.8 million a year. And that's just giving 10 cents a month from every from 90% of the utility customers in Arizona. If you bump up to a quarter, you could get $7 million. So it's a pretty appealing approach from a scale perspective. And now I want to talk about the utilities, because this is the challenge to setting something like this up, is having a good enough relationship with the utilities and having the utilities on board with doing something like this. So why would a utility want to partner with us in this effort? One reason is infrastructure protection. So those three utilities that serve 90% of the population in Arizona have power lines and transmission lines across the state. They, in the fires that Arizona's been having, the Rodeo Chudesky fire, the Wawa fire, the Monument fire, a lot of that infrastructure has been at risk. They actually had a fire last year where one of the big power providers had to shut down their transmission lines, which cost them several million dollars. So they have an interest in protecting their power lines. So I have a little slogan there, protect our pines and power lines, and that's how I was trying to sell it to the utilities, is their little marketing piece. And the other is water delivery, and this gets to the payment for watershed service idea that they are invested in these watersheds. If they burn up, they're going to have to spend a lot to do water treatment activities. So they have a vested interest in the forests. And the other one is that it just does provide them with a marketing opportunity, a good steward or green marketing campaign, so they can say they're helping get this good work done. So partnering, that's why they would want to participate. Now, why would we want to participate or work with them to set up this type of mechanism? One is that they're a uniquely efficient distribution and collection mechanism. Not only can they help us collect opt-in or opt-out donations from ratepayers, but they can also help with outreach efforts to customers to let them know why they're giving, or maybe even have them give more by doing bill inserts or helping develop other kinds of distribution and outreach materials. Utilities have a lot of resources that they can help with. The other way they can help is by facilitating direct fundraising with other businesses. Utilities work with all the large businesses in the state. They have key account representatives that can put you in touch with other businesses. And so that could be a very helpful tool if you take a direct fundraising approach. There's also a lot of challenges to working with utilities, and this is presenting a challenge to the statewide efforts, the Arizona Watershed Investment Fund efforts. The first is the speed of change within utilities. Presenting an idea to a utility is hard enough, but then having them grab that idea and run with it is a whole other challenge. They're very hierarchical organizations. Decisions are made slowly, and they aren't likely to change quickly. The second challenge is state regulation. A lot of states have regulated utilities, meaning that anytime you even want to change the text on the utility bill, it has to be approved by a regulatory commission. That is the case in Arizona for all but one utility. So if we do get the utilities to even sign on, we then have to approach the state regulatory board and have them make the changes that we'd like to. There's some institutional barriers. One of the big challenges that we're facing in Arizona is that one of the large utilities has a policy against including opt-in or opt-out donations on their bill. Not to say that we can't work with them to change that, or that there might be other ways to work with them by actually having it included in the rates by working through the state commission, but that's a huge barrier. And then the last challenge I have here is the desire and need for control of expenditures. And this is a challenge anytime you're dealing with someone who gives a lot of money to an effort. if people are going to give or businesses are going to give a lot of money, they want control over how that money is spent, meaning they might want to narrow the scope of where the work is going to be done or how that work is going to be done or what type of work is going to be done. And they aren't likely to give to a statewide fund that could, where they don't have a say in how that money is spent, basically. And that's a challenge, I think, that we're going to continue to run into Arizona. So the next step for the Arizona Watershed Investment Fund, long-term strategy, I think we need to keep working on the idea of utility-based opt-in or opt-out donations, but we need to recognize that's not going to happen for quite some time. So in the short term, the strategy is to really get the mechanisms in place to set a fund like that up, but then to take on a more direct fundraising strategy approaching businesses to get some to get them to donate to that fund. And it remains to be seen whether or not that effort's going to succeed, but there's a lot of folks who are very excited about it and the possibility that it might take off. So with that, I'm done with my two examples.
Thank you, Marcus. That was a lot of information and I think a really useful step-by-step play on what works and what is happening in Arizona. I want to let everyone know that we have about 10 minutes for questions. I think Story has to dash. We might be able to have a little bit more time for Marcus to answer questions. So if you do have questions, please press star 1, and I will answer them in the order that they are asked. I guess one question that I had, and you both sort of walked through this, in your presentations, but in the instance of the Flagstaff 405 referendum, there was sort of an event, a catastrophic event, which kind of spurred the community's interest in supporting the initiative. And so I wonder if there are recommendations or ideas about how to profile your community's interest in pursuing a similar kind of payment for watershed systems type of model in lieu of a catastrophic event. And so I don't know if you have thoughts on that. And I know a lot of what Story spoke about in terms of assessing the capital in your community is part of that process. But I just wondered if maybe you either had examples or recommendations about how to work in other contexts.
Well, I could certainly address that. I mean, Marcus probably can too. Should I take a stab at it?
Please.
There's, you know, this, because it is such a promising and proven source of money, these ballot initiatives and, you know, bond initiatives are really happening all over the United States. And the organization that's really kind of doing the best work and has the most resources to help a community is the Trust for Public Lands out of their office in Boston. And they've kind of gotten this down to an art or a science or whatever. Nature Conservancy also can offer help, but TPL really has a whole office that's dedicated to this, and they have they also have an office in Seattle. Dee Frankfurth is up in Seattle, and they also have one in Florida. That's Will Albringer, who all work on these ballot initiatives, and there really is a process for doing it. And early in the process, I mean, and Marcus is talking about really, they did such a fabulous job. It's very impressive. And one of the things that has made it harder since 08 is a fear on the part of the leaders, whether it be the county commissioners or whomever, to put these items on the ballot, not because they won't pass, but because they kind of look elitist. And so what he did was what Marcus clearly did was he put together just a great coalition, and that's sort of a new step in the process. But to answer your question directly, one of the very first steps in a lot of communities, if you don't know how to really sell this, is to do polling. And TPL can help you with the questions and put together the poll. And you don't have to poll a lot of people. It's not cheap to do a really professional political poll, but the results are really amazing. And in most communities, what comes up, unlike really the situation, or not exactly the same as the situation in Arizona, is that, you know, water. Drinking water is the most important thing. And that then becomes integral to how you write the ballot language and how you sell the campaign. But really, you learned so much from polling in terms of what your voters care about when it comes to open space and what they care about in terms of restoration. And you just take that data and you use it throughout the whole process of developing the campaign.
Okay, great. That's helpful. Marcus, did you have anything to add?
No, I think that's exactly right. And we actually had considered using the Trust for Public Lands for our campaign. The timing, we were on a pretty tight schedule, and we also had a pretty small budget, and that proved to be problematic for us, so we just decided to kind of wing it. And luckily that worked, but I think that what Stuart mentioned is definitely the preferred approach of doing some polling, bringing in some experts and having that done. There is always the option, though, of pointing to other examples, even if your community didn't experience it, pointing to similarly situated communities that have faced those types of terrible problems in the past.
Yeah, that makes sense. Another question for you, Marcus, and please, everyone, if you have questions, press star one and feel free to ask them. But I know that, most of the people that are affiliated with our organization are focused on more of the kind of riparian issues. And it's my understanding that with the 405 referendum or bond, there was a link made between kind of the water quality control, fire, post-fire management, and then riparian conditions. Is that accurate, or could you speak to that, Marcus?
Yeah, there is. It was more tied to the Lake Mary watershed, and it had to do with doing some stream and spring restoration work within that watershed, the idea being that any type of watershed work that we do in there is going to help out or help reduce later costs through water treatment of reservoir water coming out. So we did tie it to that, but it was more of keeping the whole watershed and keeping up the ecological integrity of the entire watershed, basically.
Mm-hmm. And what was your budget? You said you didn't have a big budget. Could you just maybe generally provide us with an idea?
Yeah, so when we started, we had zero budget, and we conducted some fundraising activities, a lot of just going out and knocking on doors, trying to get money, email blasts. We ended up raising a little bit less than $10,000. Some organizations, some environmental organizations contributed, and community organizations contributed $500 to around $1,000 or $2,000. But a lot of just going out and getting money, and we ended up working with, I think it was around $9,000 as our final budget.
Oh, that's great. Okay, well, so far no one has been brave enough to ask questions. So we might be reaching the conclusion of our webinar. Oh, we have one here.
Can you hear me?
Hi. Please go ahead and ask your question.
Hey, Story, this is a question for you. Let's go back to your apps that you talked about, and I can't remember the name of it, and I wrote it down here, so Travel Stories GPS. Would you take just a minute or two and explain that again?
I would love to. basically, my feeling was that conservation groups, really most of them didn't have the resources to meet people where they increasingly are, which is on their smartphones and their mobile devices, and also where they are, which is on the roads. Using the thinking that I'm looking for assets and how do I get my hands into those assets, I thought, well, maybe we should develop an app, a phone app, and it's an iPhone app, also works on iPad, and it will soon be out on the Android, that gave conservation organizations a way to get into the cars, get onto the rivers of people who are obsessively on their phones and tablets all the time. So the way the app works is it's audio tours, but any organization can put their their own content into a root, and we can put it up on the app. So it's really going to be a shared platform. And we already have two routes up in Jackson, Wyoming, and we're working on three other routes here. And then I'm working on some routes elsewhere, including one down the Southwest. So, if it works, and these things are very, very risky, it would provide these audio tours that would help get your content out in an engaging way. I mean, you can't just, lecture to people or they won't listen to it. So they have to be really engaging stories. And the stories are GPS triggered. So as you go by a particular piece of property or an access point for a river or whatever, you learn about what's going on there, maybe some engaging, interesting stories about people who – the history of the area or whatever. And in my pilot, I actually have four channels, a history channel, a natural history channel, and then a fun for kids channel, and share your own stories channel as a way for local people to kind of put their own stories on the platform as well. And then there is a function that's kind of an impulse, or that's how I designed it, sort of an impulse-driven function where at a certain point you've learned a little bit about the organization, you've seen some incredible work that they've done because the story of the organization can be woven in along the route. There's a very modest ask for $5, and it's three taps on your phone. No, you don't have to get out your credit card. You don't have to do PayPal. It's just the donor, the $5 appears on the donor's telephone bill, and the $5 goes to the organization. So if you're in an area with a lot of traffic and you have a way of marketing the app so that a lot of people might use it, being able to tap into the actual dollars that the tourists might be willing to give because at that moment they've heard something wonderful about you and they're down there appreciating the landscape that you've helped protect, they might make a gift. So there is this gift function, and we're testing it to see how well it does, but the whole idea goes back to my original sort of idea of sort of getting my hands into the tourists, the pot of money that is tourism in a lot of the areas that we work in. So it's currently on the App Store, the Apple App Store, if you want to take a look at it. The spelling uses my name, story, with a Y, so it's Travel Stories, STORYS, GPS. And, if you have an iPhone or an iPad, download it, and I'd love some feedback. We're doing right now some user-based testing, and we're doing a major optimization of the content and the technology just to make it more smooth. And actually, frankly, when you do an app, you always are improving it. But we're just doing a big improvement right now of it before we go into a big marketing campaign that we're doing this summer. One thing I will say about developing an app is that, donors are very interested in seeing their organizations get into this new space. And raising money to help with the development, it didn't cover all of it, but it has covered some, and it's covering a lot of the optimization and a whole marketing plan we were able to do with foundation and donor fundraising, because there just isn't a lot happening in conservation in this space, and that's where people are. So, and then I'll just say one more thing. In addition to a fundraising tool, I'm really hoping that it will enrich the experience of the user of the land, because we're an urbanizing culture and people are losing touch with the landscape. And if they don't know the stories of the land, they're not going to love the land. And if they don't love the land, they're not going to say yes on a ballot to vote for open space funding for Arizona or whatever. So the real purpose of this is to really reconnect people to land through stories.
Okay, good. Thank you for that. That's even more thorough, and we'll take a look at it. Thank you.
Great. Thank you.
So it doesn't look like we have any more questions from our audience, and we are at about 1:35. So I'm going to wrap us up here and thank both Story and Marcus very much for their very informative presentations. I think this was really, really interesting, and there are a lot of examples of success happening throughout the United States, and I'm going to volunteer both of them and their email addresses to answer any follow-up questions, which you can access through me at kjesperson@tamarackcoalition.org. And thanks so much for participating, and have a good rest of your Thursday. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Bye. Bye.